Morning. I read this morning from Genesis a little bit about Joseph and his coat of many colors, and I may have oversold it at the time because I'm not going to be spending too much time on that, but I am going to be speaking a little bit this morning about finding the proper motivation. The story of Joseph there was lots of motivation going on from the brothers, from Joseph, from his father, and they all were not the greatest motivation, but they all found motivation. So, as a starting point, it's a black background with dark text. It's not going to help much, no matter what. Well, as a starting point, you're all familiar with, now it's a completely black screen, just so you all know, it is black, that is what's supposed to be. As a starting point, you're all familiar with motivational posters, right? Some, you see them on the internet, some workplaces put them up, some people put them up just because they like them, whatever reason. I have a couple examples for you. Now the screen is not completely black. They almost always have the same format. We've got a picture of some kind of scenic thing, or maybe somebody doing something amazing. This one up on the screen, it's a desert scene, for those of you listening along. It says journey, because there's always a big word on the bottom, so journey. And then in small text, some kind of inspirational quote or idea. This one says it's a quote from Booker T. Washington. I didn't look it up to verify if this is correct or not. It's journey. You measure the size of the accomplishment. Let me start over. You measure the accomplishment. Start over again. Third time's the charm. Journey. You measure the size of the accomplishment by the obstacles you had to overcome to reach your goals. That was really hard, Booker T. Washington. Here's what should be easier. This is a desert scene again. This is a different kind of desert. This is more of a sand dune. Ah, they don't need to see that part. This one is challenge. And this one's really small text. Always set the trail, never follow the path. Now you can see a guy walking along and there are footsteps behind him, not in front of him. So he is setting the trail. That is a very, very motivational. Now the bottom, let's see if the bottom's on there. Yeah. Customer service. And this one has dots in between each letter. I guess the C is important and the U is important and the S is important and the T is important. Customer service. This is a picture of a lighthouse on the ocean because nobody needs service more than sailors. The sea of change can pull customers in many directions. See if I can make it bigger on my screen. Probably not. Let's see. Nope. Okay. The sea of change can pull customers in many directions. It is one's responsibility to light the way and take care of them before the competition does. Isn't that so motivational? As a customer service person, that doesn't affect me at all. I don't care. You're a bad customer, go somewhere else. That's a really bad attitude of mine, but these things don't do too much for me. And the last one I have here, sort of, is success. Again, we've got the dots in between each letter. We have a canoe on a lake, maybe a river, and it says success is a journey, not a destination. Doesn't that just make you want to go somewhere? That is so motivational. That makes me just want to do something. For people with this mindset, which again, not me, but there's a lot of them out there because these things have consistently been big sellers. Lots of people have them. You go into just about any business, you can find something like this somewhere in that business. It's supposed to motivate you to do more. And so for those of you who these do help, I have selected a couple of motivational posters, sort of, and we're going to look into some of the thoughts and ideas. First poster I have here is achievement. And it's got a blade of grass with a water drop dripping off of it. It says, only the tall grass gets cut. Okay, this isn't a motivational poster. This is a demotivational poster, as they are referred to on the internet. So it takes something big and fancy. It takes the exact same format. It's got the big, pretty picture. It's got the big word that says something that's important, achievement. And then it's got a phrase that is not particularly appropriate towards the idea of motivating somebody. So the idea of achievement is you want to be the best you can. You want to be the one who rises above everybody else. You want to be the tall grass, as it were. And then the text here says the tall grass gets cut. So those who achieve, those who overachieve, those who do good, they're the ones that are going to get knocked down. And to that end, I do have a couple of passages that we're going to look at. The first one in 1 Samuel 17, 4 through 11. Any guesses on who this may be about? Saul, that's a good guess, but that's actually the next one. He's back a couple chapters. 1 Samuel 17, there came out of the camp of the Philistines a champion named Goliath. Goliath of Gath. His height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a helmet of bronze on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze, and he had bronze armor on his legs and a javelin of bronze slung between his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron. And his shield bearer went before him. He stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why have you come out to draw up for battle? Am I not a Philistine? And are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us." And the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Goliath, he was big. He was strong. And that's it. His achievement was he was the peak of physical perfection, I guess, of the day. He was a really big man, whether that was 6 cubits or 4, which would be the difference between 6 feet and 9 feet. Whether he was the strongest man, he had some pretty impressive armament, really, really big and heavy weapons and armor. He was the peak of physical perfection of the time. He was the, Dwayne Johnson? Yeah, Arnold Schwarzenegger's too old. He's not really that anymore, but he was the rock of the day. And so he goes out there and he's, "I am the biggest, baddest guy here. I am the achiever. All of you all are just short little grass compared to me." And we know what happened to Goliath. We have the little podunk who? David. We had David's little podunk who comes up. He says, "Well, I can do that. Well, okay, not me, but God can do that, and he can use me to do that." And so we have this little guy, David, who, okay, he wasn't a runt. He wasn't a shrimp or anything, but David compared to Goliath, nobody would have picked him in that battle. And we have David who goes and he cuts that tall grass. "Goliath, your achievements, they're nothing to me. They're nothing to God. We're going to go and we're going to chop down that grass." So, story number one, the tall grass got cut. Yay! Okay, story number two, we're going to jump back a couple chapters and look at another example of tall grass. And Ben, who was that other tall grass? Saul. Saul was also a tall man. In 1 Samuel 9, in chapter 8, Israel says, "We want a king." And Samuel says, "That's not a great idea." But God says, "I've got a guy for you." So in 1 Samuel 9, there was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, son of Zeror, son of Bechorath, son of Aphiah, a Benjamite, a man of wealth. And he had a son whose name was Saul, a handsome young man that was not a man. There was not a man among the people of Israel more handsome than he. From his shoulders upward, he was taller than any of the people. So maybe he had a really long neck. I have a pretty long neck, but maybe his neck was really long. So what great skills and abilities does Samuel regale us with about Saul? Well, it wasn't his great leadership. He obviously later on did take up leadership and people followed him. Not necessarily 100% right at first, because we have the coronation of Saul, you will, and then everybody goes home. So he didn't start out being a great leader of men, but he was really tall. And that's one of the signs of leadership. You go to watch TV and you say, "That guy's really tall, he's the lead of the show." And "That guy's not really tall, he's not the lead of the show." That's true 80% of the time or so. You go to businesses, the tall guys usually are the ones who've risen to the top of the business environment as well. So Saul was really tall. And that made him a great guy. That made him the guy they wanted. Now obviously we don't have the same vision as God. God looked and he said, "Saul, there's something potentially great about this guy." And the same thing, he looked at David and he said, "David, he's not necessarily the same stature and everything that Saul was, but there's something potentially really great about this guy." And so we don't have the same vision as God to be able to look at people and say, well, this guy is really great on the inside. But we do have a principle. Is anybody familiar with the Peter principle? This is actually coined by, let's see, what's his name? Dr. Lawrence J. Peter. Yeah. Dr. Lawrence J. Peter, in a 1969 book called The Peter Principle, there's a guy who likes to put his name out, but he has this idea that he observed that in a hierarchy, people tend to rise to the level of incompetence. Okay, that's something that any of us who work are fairly familiar with. When you're good at something, you get promoted to the next thing up, whether you're good at it or not. Because, hey, he was really good at saying hi to customers, maybe he'll be really good at taking their cash. No, he's just really good at saying hi to the customers. He loses the cash. There's this idea that when you're good at something, you get promoted to the next level up, whether you're good at it or not, and you keep doing that until you get promoted to the level where you're not good at it anymore. And then they can't really knock you back down because they've already put them there, and so you rise to your level of incompetence. That's kind of what we have with Goliath and with Saul. Goliath, he rose to a point where I'm the best that I can be. And look, nobody's better than me. Whoops, I was wrong. And Saul had a little bit of the same thing going on, where he's the tallest guy. He's the most kingly looking person here. He's maybe doesn't have all the attributes, but he is the best looking guy here for this job. And whoops, he kind of failed. He didn't pull through with all the aspects that God wanted him to do. We have it just last Wednesday. I was talking about the law, and one of the things in the law was when you have a king, he's going to write down the law and he needs to look at it and read from it every day and remember the law and how he's supposed to act as a king. I get the impression Saul didn't do that, even though it wasn't a huge amount of time between the time that God said that and the time that Saul became king, 100 years, 200 years, something like that. I don't get the impression that Saul followed through on that law and wrote down everything that was in the law and kept it with him on a daily basis. He didn't follow through on that aspect. And he too, as a tall blade of grass, got cut down eventually. Another aspect of this, if we look at the New Testament Christian view on greatness, both Goliath and Saul, they were great men in their time. They did great things. They rose above. They achieved more than other people in their areas of expertise. Goliath as a warrior and Saul as a king, I guess, as a Israelite becoming a king. If we look at Acts 10 and verses 25 and 26, we have a different attitude on this. It says, Cornelius met him. So Peter entered a house, and Cornelius met him. Peter entered Cornelius' house. When Peter entered, Cornelius met him, fell down at his feet, and worshipped him. But Peter lifted him up, saying, "Stand up, stand up. I too am a man." Okay, so there's a different attitude here. We have Goliath, who says, "I'm the best man here. Nobody can stand up against me." We have Saul, who became king and went on and did many kingly things. He accumulated kingly wealth. He took people and made them his servants. And he did all these things that a king does. He became better than everybody else. And that was one of the things in the law. Specifically, the king is not better than all the Israelites. And Saul became better than the Israelites when he became their king. And Peter here, he sees a man who falls down and worships him. And Peter says, "I'm a man too." Also in Acts 14, another example of the same thing in verses 11 through 17. When the crowd saw what Paul had done, they lifted up their voices saying in Lyconian, "The gods have come down to us in likeness of man." Barnabas they called Zeus and Paul Hermes because he was the chief speaker. And if we skip down a little bit, Paul says, "Men, why are you doing these things? We also are men or of like nature with you. And we bring you good news that you should turn from these vain things to a living God who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that is in them. In past generations, he allowed all the nations to walk in their own ways, yet he did not leave himself without witnesses. For he did good by giving you rains from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your hearts with food and gladness." And that gives us an idea here that both Paul and Peter espouse that in the Christian realm, there is no one better than the other. That's the idea that God wanted with the Israelites when he said the king is on the same law as everybody else. Peter and Paul here both say, in Christ, we're all on a level playing field. There's no one better than others. You don't worship other people. You don't say, "I am the greatest. I am the tallest blade of grass. You should all follow me." We're
getting that point in Acts in the morning class with the Simon the sorcerer. He wanted to be better than everybody else. He wanted the powers that the apostles had. And Peter and Paul both say that's not the way it works. You don't be better than the Christian better than all the other Christians. You be the best Christian you can be, which makes you the same as all the other Christians. Colossians 3:23 sums that up to the final extent here on this motivational poster here. Colossians 3:23, whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord, not for men. We are not achieving for each other. We're not achieving for ourselves. We're not King Nebuchadnezzar who looks around and says, look at all this amazing stuff I've done. We're not Saul who says, I'm the greatest king, and we're not Goliath who says, I'm the greatest warrior. We are working for the Lord, not for men. So our achievements are not for ourselves. We're not looking to be the tallest blade of grass, the beautifulest blade of grass. We'll get to that in a moment. And so, in that respect, we're not worried about getting cut because we're not going to be the best out there, but we are going to be the exact right height to just slip under the lawnmower so that we can be what God needs us to be. We have not been called to be the tallest grass or to have our achievements lauded by others. All right, next motivational poster. So we've got four pencils here. Three of them have been worn down to little nubs of lead, little nubs of graphite. The next picture is the other part. And we have one pencil that is brand new, freshly sharpened. And it says, distinction. Looking sharp is easy when you haven't done any work. All right, so Goliath, I'm thinking he probably put a lot of work into being what he was. Saul, eventually, he put quite a bit of work into being king. On the other hand, Peter and Paul, they put a lot of work into being what they were, as being good Christians. But the idea here that it's easy to look good when you haven't done anything. It's easy to walk into, you go to an event, and there's people who are working really hard at that event, trying to make the event the best they can be, And you can tell, they look frazzled, they look worn out, they're not looking the greatest. If they are somebody wearing makeup, then it may be in misplaced. If somebody with nice hair, then it's not in the correct position. I don't have a problem with either of those, because I don't have either of those. But it's easy to look good when you don't do any work. It's easy to walk into a place after all the work has been done in your suit or whatever and say, hey, looking good, guys. And to that end, I have a story in 1 Kings 18. This is one of my favorite stories of many, but the story in 1 Kings 18, verses 18 through 24, that's Elijah, and he's talking to Ahab. And Ahab says, you caused so much trouble. And Elijah says, I have not troubled Israel, but you have, and your father's house, because you have abandoned the commandments of the Lord and followed the Baals. Now therefore, send and gather all Israel to me at Mount Carmel, and the 450 prophets of Baal, and the 400 prophets of Asherah, who eat at Jezebel's table. Excuse me. Now, this lends to mind me, you have Elijah, the hardworking man of God, and he says that on a regular basis. I'm the only prophet of God left. I'm the only one working for God left. And that's a little bit of a fail on his part. But he is. He's out there and he's gotta be looking frazzled. He's gotta be one of these pencils with a short nub because he's out there. He's doing the work. He's making the effort to do what God wants done. On the other hand, you have these prophets of Baal and these prophets of Asherah. And it says they eat at Jezebel's table, which means they live a pretty cushy life. They aren't doing a lot of work. And they gotta go out there and show the people, hey, look at me, I'm a prophet. See how amazing things are for me as a prophet? And on the other hand, look at Elijah, he's all tore up, he's beat up. And that's a fairly common theme among the prophets of God, that they aren't necessarily the best looking guys in there. We can look all the way to John the Baptist in the New Testament, and he dressed in camel's hair, he ate locusts and wild honey. That does not sound like an idyllic lifestyle to me. We have Elijah here. Several times he's not living in perfect situations. He goes and lives with a widow who doesn't have anything. He goes and lives by a ravine. He's fed by ravens, if I remember. So we have this idea of God's prophets. They not necessarily getting the minimum, but they are working hard, and it shows. So we have the story here again back in Kings, and Ahab calls all the people of Israel and gathers all the prophets in Mount Carmel. And Elijah comes to the people and says, how long will you go limping between two different opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him. And the people did not answer him a word. Then Elijah said to the people, I, even I only, am left a prophet of the Lord. But Baal's prophets are 450 men. Let two bulls be given to us, and let them choose one bull for themselves and cut it in pieces and lay it on the wood, but put no fire to it. And I will prepare the other bull and lay it on the wood and put no fire to it. And you call upon the name of your God, and I will call upon the name of the Lord, the God, the Lord. And the God who answers by fire, he is God. And all the people answered, it is well spoken. Baal looking, oh, that's my line. Baal was looking pretty until he was called to do some work. And if we remember the way the story goes, the prophets of Baal, they start dancing around, they start slashing themselves, they get blood everywhere, they start getting just exhausted. Once they actually start working, nothing happens. And Elijah taunts them and he goads them and he says, maybe your God is asleep, shout louder, what's going on? Doesn't he answer you? Because he knows that once they actually start getting some work done, they're going to look so bad compared to him. And then we have Elijah, the man who's already been worked, he's already down to the ends of his lead, and he very simply pours water on it, and he calls the Lord, and fire comes down and shows up all the Baal. So, did Elijah look good going into it? Not really. Coming out of it, he's still this worn out guy, but I'd rather have that worn out guy than that pencil with the sharp lead, because you know what happens to that pencil with the really sharp lead? You stick it down to the paper and the tip breaks off. It's so sharp that it's ineffective until you get that little bit of sharpness worn off. This is also where I have in my notes here to talk about Joseph. Joseph had the same kind of thing going on. He had this amazing coat. He was loved by his father. He was the apple of his eye and the most amazing coat, a ornamental coat, a coat of many colors, a beautiful coat or a robe or cloak or whatever it's translated as. And it wasn't his pretty coat. It wasn't the love of his father. It wasn't even the dreams that he had that brought him to greatness. When Joseph became great, it was because he put his head down and he got to the work. And he didn't particularly worry about how good it made him look. I have a hard time believing that he was a servant in Potiphar's house or working in the jail saying, hey, look, I'm the best looking guy here. No, he was putting his head down and getting to the work. And the last note I have on this slide regarding John the Baptist, about how he looked, and Elijah, how he worked, and Joseph, how they all got down to brass tacks and didn't worry about it, was do the work, don't work the look. That's a phrase that people use, right? Work the look. The best distinction we can achieve in life, again, distinction being the word on the poster here, the best distinction we can achieve in life is living a life worthy of the Lord. And that's the life that Elijah lived, that's the life that Joseph finally came to live, that's the life that John the Baptist did live with out in the wilderness, and that's the life that we too need to live. Not worrying about the outside appearance, not trying to be the Saul or the Goliath, or the prophet of Baal who sits at Jezebel's Asherah, the prophet of Asherah who sits at Jezebel's table and dines with the queen. We need to worry about working for the Lord. Again, there's that idea that we had that was in Colossians, right? Working for the Lord, not for man. So the last poster I have here, sort of the last one. Now we have the pencils that are all sharpened down to the nubs. We've got just a little tiny bit of pencil left, just an inch or two of pencil left, which means that these pencils have really gone through a lot. They've written papers and dissertations and they've filled out surveys. These pencils have done a lot in their lifetime. Their lifetime is just about over. Okay, so the word on this poster is effort. The harder you work, the less you have left to give. Isn't that great? Isn't that motivational? The more you do, the less you can do. That just fires me up. Some of the ideas on this one are true. To a degree, the more you do, the less you have left to give. And on the other hand, you look at it that what did these pencils accomplish in their lifetime? During their lifetime, they did great things, potentially. In 2 John, verse 8, 2 John, only one chapter, right? Verse 8, John says, watch yourselves that you may not lose what we have worked for, but may win a full reward. The effort is the important part, not how we look at the end. That same idea of distinction, that we didn't care about what we look like. The point is doing the effort. The point is putting the work in. The song, we'll work till Jesus comes, is the same idea as working for the Lord, not for men. We'll work. We'll do the work. And when we're finished, we may be a short little nub of pencil. Similar vein, I have Luke 11:39-44, and this is Jesus calling out the Pharisees. He says, "You Pharisees, clean the outside of the cup and of the dish, but inside you are full of greed and wickedness. You fools, did not he who made the outside make the inside also? But give as alms those things that are within, and behold, everything is clean for you. But woe to you Pharisees, for you tithe mint and rue and every herb, and neglect justice and the love of God. These you ought to have done without neglecting the others. Woe to you Pharisees, for you love the best seat in the synagogues and greetings in the marketplaces. Woe to you, for you are like unmarked graves, and people walk over them without knowing it." And that really shows the Pharisees put a lot of effort into one thing. What did they put a lot of effort into? Their appearances. They put a lot of effort into being that tallest blade of grass. They put a lot of effort into being that sharpest looking pencil. The previous two posters on achievement and distinction. They put a lot of effort into that. And so at the end of the day, did they end up as short little nubs of pencils? No, because they were focusing on keeping the pencil sharp, not on using the pencil. If you just put the pencil in the sharpener and you wind it a couple times every day, the pencil doesn't get any shorter because it hasn't been used. The pencil only gets shorter when it's actually used. When you actually put the effort in and knock off some of that lead in the end so that you actually do, next time you sharpen it, some has been gone, some has been worn away. Also have lots of other stories about the same kind of idea that we work. We work till Jesus comes. We work for the Lord, not for man, not worrying about the outside appearance, worrying about the inside. A vital example I have of that is Luke 15:8-9, the parable of the lost coin. Jesus simply says, "When a woman, having 10 silver coins, loses one, does she not light a lamp and sweep the house and seek diligently until she finds it? When she found it, she calls together her friends and neighbors, saying, 'Rejoice with me, for I have found the coin that I had lost.'" And he uses that as an example of the angels. When the angels see a lost soul come back, they rejoice. And we too need to rejoice. But a big part of that is the work. You put the work in. When something is lost, you put the work in. When you have something to do, you put the work in. And she doesn't worry about, well, my house is going to be a mess while I'm cleaning, looking for it, or I need to move this over here, or in the process of cleaning, I found these other things that needed to be cleaned. That's not what she's worried about. She's worried about finding that coin. And then the effort that you put into that leads to great things. These pencils, when a pencil gets down to where it's short, too short to hold, do you think the pencil's sad about that? Because pencils are great thinkers. No, they're happy. I did my job. Now I can retire to the trash can or whatever. We need to have the same attitude as the pencils. You do the good work, and you put it in, and when you're done, you look at it and you say, look at all the work I did. Look at all the amazing things I did. It was back in John, watch yourself that you don't lose what you've worked for. That's an easy thing to do. I put all this work in and look what it gave me. Nothing. I'm sitting here with nothing now because everybody took everything out of me. No. Everybody took what you gave and you made great things for lots of people. Okay, so with these posters, these three motivational posters, I thought I'd put a little effort into making my own with some of the ideas that I was trying to get across. So the text on my poster is going to be motivation. Okay? So motivation. What kind of picture could I have come up for that? All right. There you go. This is a painting called Servant with a Tray. Originally it was painted by Verheiden Francois, I think. And again, I didn't look that up particularly closely. I just looked for a picture to match what I wanted and pulled it out. So the verse, I haven't given you the subtext yet, but motivation, there is a servant with a tray. The verses I've selected for this as we're wrapping up here, 1 Corinthians 4, verses 1 through 5. "This is how one should regard us, as servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. Moreover, it is required of stewards that they be found faithful. But with me it is a very small thing that I should be judged by you or by any human court. In fact, I do not even judge myself, for I am not aware of anything against myself, but I am not thereby acquitted. It is the Lord who judges me. Therefore, do not pronounce judgment before the time, before the Lord comes, who will bring to light things now hidden in darkness and will disclose the purposes of the heart. Then each one will receive his commendation from God." This is, if I remember right, this is Paul. He was talking about the people here at Corinth. They said, you're having a problem with who you look to. Some of you say, well, we learned from Apollos, and some of us say we learned from Paul, and you're saying that makes you better than other people, and other people not as good because they don't have that same base that you have. He says that's not what's important. The important is to be regarded as a servant of Christ. And this goes along a little bit with Dad's table lesson a little earlier. The idea is that Nietzsche had that you need to be better than everybody else, and Paul says no. We need to be the servants of everyone else. We need to be the pencils that have gone out and done the work and gotten shortened down. And you can see we're working because we're not sharp as a tack. And you can see that we're not the tallest grass because we are servants. We're not those who are standing above and head and shoulders above everybody else. We are the servants. We are the ones who are motivated to be servants of Christ. And that is, he says here, that we do that. We don't pronounce judgment before time. We don't judge somebody based on their appearance. So that's an old pencil. I don't want to use it. We don't do that, but we do it with the expectation that each will receive his commendation from God. And isn't that the best thing? When you finish up with a pencil, you say, this was a good pencil. I'm going to buy another one just like it. That Tillamook is supposed to be the best, or no, not Tillamook. Tillamook makes ice cream. Ticonderoga? Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to buy another one of those because the other pencils, they fail when I use them, but those ones, they work really good. I'm going to buy those every time. And that's the best acclamation that we can hope for. That you were the best person I ever met. You were a Christian. You were the best I ever met. You were a good servant. You helped me. You showed me that things were better. You didn't always look the best. You weren't always the most powerful person in the room, but you showed me what a life like Christ would be like. You were the best pencil that I could have had. You were the best person I could have known. You were the one who helped me the most. And that, Paul says, is our motivation, that one day we can get that commendation from God, that we worked ourselves to the end. Because, again, mixing metaphors, those short pencils, they're not tall grass. They're the ones that don't get cut. They're the ones that Jesus looks at and says, well done, my good and faithful servant. I was naked and you clothed me. I was hungry and you fed me. I was thirsty and you gave me a drink. And so the text, if I were to put subtext up there, which I didn't, but the text that I would put up there, motivation. If you work hard enough at being a servant, you'll rise above everyone's level of incompetence. And that includes your own. I can work to the level of my incompetence and then I don't go anywhere else. And that's not a very satisfactory position to be in. But we're told in the Bible over and over again, if we work at being a servant, and we'll rise above any of our own failings. We'll rise above everyone's failings. And that is the goal that we have, that commendation from God that you are a good servant. Well done, my good and faithful servant. You've done good with little. Here's a lot. And that's where we're going to wrap up this morning. If anybody needs to take that step towards servanthood, towards being motivated for the right reasons, having the proper motivation, we offer you the opportunity to come before the congregation while we stand and Chuck leads an invitation song.